everyone. This is Stand to Reason's hashtag STRAsk podcast with Amy Hall and Greg Kokel. And we're here to respond to your questions that you send us on Twitter with the hashtag STRAsk. So, Greg.
Yes. It is I. We are here.
All right. Let's start.
To do our job.
Let's start with the first question. This one came from Sarah.
All right.
Isn't marriage an institution created by man, and thus any biblical restrictions on sexual activity before marriage or between same-sex individuals are not God-established but man-established?
Could you read that one way?
Sure.
Because it's the second half that created by man and therefore sexual.
And therefore any biblical restrictions on sexual activity before marriage or between same-sex individuals are not God-established but man-established.
Well, if the first thing is true, the second thing is true. All right. I mean, that's the second is predicated on the first. Isn't marriage established by man? And the answer is no. I'm not sure what could be more obvious. Now, I don't know if our questioner is it – what's her name? Lisa?
Sarah.
Sarah. I don't know if our questioner is a Christian or not. It's not a condescension or anything. I'm just saying. In the book of Genesis, it's a book of beginnings. And so we have the beginning of everything – except for God. We have the beginning of human beings. We have beginning of human relationships, particularly the most intimate one, which is marriage, and the beginning of the problem that all sets up what comes. So we have a layout of how God made it. This is the way it was made. Think of any contraption anybody makes, a brand new automobile, a brand new helicopter. I'm thinking of something complicated, not something simple, because the world is a complicated place. But God made it to work in a very particular kind of way. And then in chapter 3 of the story, the whole thing gets broken. All right? And everything is influenced by it. Nothing is operating completely correctly after that in this complex machine. All right. So there is a way things are supposed to be. And the era that we are in now, ever since then, is not the way the things are supposed to be. Okay. And one of the things that are the way that things are supposed to be is a plan that God made for being fruitful and multiplying. Now, human beings I'm trying to think of the right way to put it because these words have become so politicized, are heterosexual, okay? They're reproductively heterosexual. Let me put it that way. That means if you want to reproduce, it takes a man and a woman. Oh, I know there are petri dishes and odds and ends. Now, you still need a man and a woman, even though the location of the genesis of a new human being could be in a petri dish, in vitro fertilization. We are the kinds of creatures that are not asexual or sexual, and we are sexual in a way that requires a man and woman in order to reproduce and multiply, which is what God had in mind. But we are also individuals. We are creatures that have a long gestation period, 9 months. That's really long. And then the care of our offspring until they're ready to be on their own is like 30 to 60 years. It's a joke. So the point is we need stable relationships for the human species to flourish if you just want to think about it biologically. That is a descriptive statement. We're looking at the way the world is, okay? Now, the prescriptive statement that I hinted at already, God made it to be that way on purpose. This is his plan. And so when the text says that the husband shall leave the family and cleave to his wife, the two shall become one flesh, that is tied to the creation mandate of be fruitful and multiply. It's right in the same section. Okay, and Jesus identifies that as a marriage in Matthew 19. And he says it ought not be separated because that's not God's plan. God hates divorce, Malachi. He's made provision for it because of the hardness of men's hearts, but that doesn't mean he's in favor of it. Okay, so native to that enterprise that God established are certain necessary sexual restrictions. Okay? In fact, every restriction in the scripture to sexual behavior pertains to sex outside with humans outside of the marriage relationship. That would be adultery, fornication, homosexuality, and bestiality. Now, one just has to reflect for a moment. Adultery, fornication, homosexuality, bestiality. It's pretty obvious when you think of the basic plan that those things are outside of that basic plan. All right? The first two produce a sexual communion and union and potentially children outside of the protected relationship of a long-term committed marriage. The second two are perversions of God's purpose for sex itself. Okay? Now, it seems to me anybody observing the biblical record and largely observing the nature of reality who is not committed to self-satisfaction at all costs can see that. Even if I wasn't a Christian, I didn't believe in God, I didn't believe at all, I would look at it and I think I could say, I can see how that would be restricted in that book given that plan. That makes sense in that world. But we don't live in that world. We live in a world that man made, that man does what he wants. He makes all the rules. Well, that's the world of relativism. It's also the word of tyranny, oppression, and totalitarianism. Because all of the freedoms, this is a good point. I should write it down somewhere. All of the freedoms that we think, all the freedoms that we think that relativism gives also gives freedom to the things I just mentioned, totalitarianism, oppression, abuse, because there are no restrictions, all right? So anyway, I'm a little flummoxed by the question.
I suspect, just based on the other questions that she's sent in, I think somebody has been asking her these questions and she's not sure how to respond. Okay. So I do think she is a Christian.
God bless her. Good. And I apologize, Lisa.
Sarah.
Sarah. You said Sarah. I wrote Lisa. Okay, Sarah, thank you. Now, I'm not presuming. I'm just trying to figure this out. So this is coming from probably a non-Christian source. But this is the main question. Is it true that man created it? If it is true that this is man's creation, man could uncreate it and create anything he wants, because if it's just man, there are no restrictions except for natural ones, I mean like gravity. There are no restrictions to what man wants to do. He can make anything he wants that satisfies him in the moment. But by the way, that includes anything any individual wants. That includes Stalin and Lenin and Mao and Pol Pot and Hitler and Himmler and Goebbels and all the rest of them, all right? There is no moral principle that restrains those behaviors either. And somebody might be saying, are you saying that premarital sex then outside of God's plan or outside of a divinely created universe is as bad as what Hitler did? No, I'm saying none of them are bad. None of them are bad, because bad has no meaning in that world. The only thing that exists is pleasure and power. And the more power you get, the more pleasure you can have for yourself. Not for other people, obviously, but for yourself. And that is the consequence of relativism.
Just to underscore something you've touched on here, it's instituted by God. But it's not even that it's arbitrary. It's actually tied into the way we were created. I think that you made that point, and I think that's so important to underscore. It's related to the nature of reality and who we are as human beings and how we function and how we best function. I just wanted to read what what Jesus said about this in 19. I want to read the actual words because, Sarah, you might want to, if somebody's trying to understand what Christianity has to say about this, here's what Jesus said in Matthew 19. Have you not read that he who created them from the beginning made them male and female and said, for this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh? So they are no longer two, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let no man separate. Mm-hmm. So it's very explicit there, what God joined together, and mm-hmm. the idea that marriage is the two becoming one flesh.
Right. Now, if Sarah's friend that she's pressing on this disagrees, well, I understand that. I just, what I'm trying to help people see is on the one hand, there are two competing worldviews here, basically. One is the Christian worldview, and then there is the idea that institutions and even morality, I think is implicit there, are man-made, all right? Well, those are different worldviews, okay? And each entails particular consequences. So if the world is made a certain way, and back to the machinery illustration, if it's made to operate and function well by God a certain way, then if you get, you know, you start getting grit and dust into the gears, so to speak, or something gets broken, it's not going to work, or it's not going to work very well. And this is precisely what we see. We see all kinds of disastrous results when people they depart from the way of operating the way God intended things to function. It started out, everything God made was good. That means it was all working the way he wanted it to work. It's just right. Everything was the way it's supposed to be. Now, people know the world is not the way it's supposed to be. But of course, that can't be the case if there is no God, because there is no way the world's supposed to be, because there's no sposer. So, okay, so, and that's the consequence of the other side. If you want to say, all right, fine, I'm out of there, I'm doing my own thing, I get to make my own rules. Fine, then you can make your own rules. And guess what? Everybody else gets to make their own rules too. And the one with the most power gets to live by his rules. It's just that simple. And this is what relativists are not happy with. They want to be relativists themselves, but they don't want other people to be relativists towards them. And this is why when you listen to them talk, you'll hear them talking out of both sides of their mouth in the same sentence. Morals are relative. There is no absolute morality. There's no rules guiding the whole universe. Therefore, don't push your morality on me. You hear it? There it is. Both sides competing with each other. If there is no morality governing the universe, what is keeping me, other than power in the moment, from pushing my morality on you? Nothing. It is entirely legitimate if I can get away with it. And this is what people refuse to accept, and they're blinded to it, I think, largely, until it's pointed out to them, because what they want is their own way, and that's the garden. That's right back there in the beginnings, the beginnings of the beginnings of everything, in Genesis, where the problem came from. No, I'm not following God. I'm going to be my own God. I'm going to do it my way, and that's what we have now.
So along those same lines, here's a question from Vance Gatlin. How should I respond when two Christians who are dating get pregnant out of wedlock? It's always awkward, like saying congratulations is affirming the sin of premarital sex.
Yeah, this is a very difficult one. By the way, only one's getting pregnant. The other one, this is a side. It's part of the plan, how that works. But I understand what he means. But it's interesting that he put it that way, because I think he's trying to put it sensitively, because it is common for married couples to say, we are having a baby, and that affirms the legitimate union and the building of a family, when this is not what's going on, nor was it planned. And I don't know what to say about that, to be honest with you. On the one hand, you don't want to affirm something sinful, but the thing that's sinful is not getting pregnant. this thing that's sinful is the premarital sex that had been going on probably a while before they were getting pregnant, before the young lady got pregnant, and wonder what people said about it then if they knew about it. And a lot of times they don't say anything about it. And then it becomes, oh my gosh, you're pregnant. It's an illegitimate child. We don't use that language anymore, but we used to. And thankfully we don't, because the child's not illegitimate. The behavior was illicit. But we don't address the illicit behavior. We address the consequence of the behavior. So it is always a miracle of sorts when a new child is being brought into the world, and we can celebrate that. I think now I'm thinking it through. I think we can celebrate that. At the same time, it creates a whole host of new difficulties for everybody, for the mother, for the father, for the families, and for the communities. A massive host of difficulties because somebody just wanted to do what they wanted to do.
Mm-hmm. I think the answer probably depends somewhat on the situation and how close you are to them. I haven't really had to deal with this a whole lot, so I'm not sure how I would respond, but I wonder if it would be appropriate just to say, so what are your plans? Are you going to get married? Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that's a legitimate question. Are you
sure? Yeah, you know, I think pregnancy is not a good not a good reason to get married. But I mean, shotgun weddings in the past were one thing, but this isn't. I'm not sure. I guess my own opinion about that should be that the relationship should be assessed on its merits, and one of the elements now is a child. Okay, but I don't think that is the only thing. If it's a fly by night relationship, you know, and that can't be made into, that's unlikely to be made into a good marriage. Let's put it that way. And that's not going to be good for anybody. Okay. If it's already established relationship, then it might be good to tie the knot as quickly as possible. And that used to be done with some regularity in the past, you know, so that, and even kids have done, wait a minute, you're married when, and how old am I? And they do the math and they realize that mom and dad got pregnant before they were married. And then they made it right and secured the home environment that would provide for a good family upbringing, and I think that's a good idea, frankly. But I think it's a fair question. You could say, so what are your plans? Yeah, because if their plans are abortion, that's something you want to step in and say, wait.
It's kind of hard. I guess it's hard for me to imagine somebody coming out without some sort of sense of, what's the word I'm looking for? Just announcing it joyfully with no sense of repentance in it, mm-hmm. of any sort. It's hard for me to imagine that not being an element of this. And I guess it's possible. I guess you could be at a church where they don't think it's wrong, or I'm just not sure. But if there is some element of repentance, obviously you would show grace. Obviously you're not going to chastise them further. Right. But
well, again, the wrong is not getting pregnant. The wrong is the mm-hmm. behavior that was habitual that led up to that, that resulted in pregnancy. That's the key.
It has to be hard to have that sin revealed so openly and publicly if you're in a community where they actually believe that it's wrong. Mm-hmm. I'm sure there are churches out there where people, especially younger people, don't take it seriously at all.
Right. That's right. That's right. So it's the hard part really is finding the golden mean, to use kind of Aristotle's terminology, that somewhere in the middle, so to speak, and that is having a moral compass that's intact enough to know that the behaviors are wrong, and that if the behaviors are discovered as a result of the pregnancy, then there's a propriety to address the behavior, but at the same time not be so, in a sense, on the other extreme, so moralistic about it that you reject the person in a difficult circumstance and bring disfavor upon the child him or herself. And that's what's happened in the past. You know, even Jesus was accused of being a bastard child implicitly in one of the texts where the Pharisees, the leaders said, "We are not born of adultery." They make this comment, which, you know, it seems to implicitly be referring to the questionable birth of Jesus or conception of Jesus. Oh, yeah, right. God came down. I mean, the Pharisees aren't going to believe that kind of thing. So,
yeah, these questions are really hard. And I think the reason why is because every situation will be a little bit different. And so the way to learn how to handle these situations, you just have to have wisdom. Mm-hmm. You have to develop that sense of clarity and grace and insight into what will be helpful in the situation. And so everyone is going to be different.
Yeah, that's right. You know, Jesus, maybe this last thought here, on that issue is Jesus is described in John 1 as being full of grace and truth. Grace and truth. And this is something that Alan Schliemann has especially emphasized with regards to dealing with homosexuality. It's grace and truth. It's not just truth. That's harsh. It's not just grace. That's licentious. It's grace and truth.
You know, you just reminded me when you said that, Greg, of Joseph, who's described as being both righteous and good. So because he was righteous, he was going to, you know, end his betrothal to Mary, but because he was good, he didn't want to do it in a way that would humiliate her.
Interesting, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so this distinction's made when it talks about in Romans 5 about Jesus dying for us, and it says, you know, no one's going to die for a righteous man, but someone might die for a good man. And
for a sinner, so, nobody's going to die for an unrighteous man. Is that what you said?
The idea is that nobody would give up his life for someone who was righteous.
Because,
okay. I guess,
go ahead and read it. Sorry.
Let's see.
There was such a dramatic moment there, and I messed it up for you.
It's okay. For one will hardly die for a righteous man, though perhaps for the good man someone would dare even to die.
Yeah,
In other words, we love the good man, and that's different from actually just being righteous, just being someone who follows the law
perfectly.
Oh, I
see what you're saying. Right, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so... so Joseph was both righteous and good. He wanted to follow the law, but he was also a good man who did not want to humiliate.
I never made that distinction between those words. It's a good observation. Nice going, Amy.
Just now when you said grace and truth, I think that's exactly the same kind of thing that we have to balance. So
that's right.
Good luck to all of you, because it's not easy.
This might be a good time to bring in the point, since it's Christmas time, my favorite movie on Christmas, especially Bible movie, my favorite Bible movie, in addition, is The Nativity, because it so well captures the struggle of these moments with Mary and Joseph trying to decide, for Mary, how to explain her pregnancy to her parents, for Joseph trying to struggle with the righteousness and the goodness. And it's magnificently portrayed there in a very sympathetic way, and I encourage people to take a look at that, especially Christmas time.
All right. Thanks, everyone. Thanks for your questions. We always look forward to seeing those and choosing the ones that we think will be most interesting to all of you. So it's great to have as many as possible to choose from. So we look forward to hearing from you on Twitter with the hashtag STRAsk. This is Amy Hall and Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason.